Today's Teisho will be on case 15 in the Heikigan Roku, the Pien Lu. Case 15 is entitled Umon's No Preaching on Oneness. Engo's introduction, the death-dealing blade, the life-giving sword. They were the custom in ancient days and are still today the touchstone. Tell me, at this moment, what is the death-dealing blade? What is the life-giving sword? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Umon, what is it when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself? Umon said, no preaching on oneness. Secho's verse, no oneness. Each holds one tally. He lives and dies with you all the same. The 84,000 did not respond quickly. The 33 entered the tiger's cave. Remarkable. See how turbulent the moon reflected on the waves. Thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job this morning in our sit. Some of you are now in your fourth day, and by the fourth day, your legs can be tired, and it's definitely the case that when you sat down this morning, it was a little harder than yesterday. That's not always the case, but today, tired legs might have been more of a challenge, but everybody did a wonderful job. So thank you so much for practicing so wholeheartedly. This is an interesting and important koan. A monk asked Umon, what is it when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself? Umon said, no preaching on oneness. Now this is a really curious exchange, because we are told that we should enter a state where no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself. In other words, mushin. A monk is basically saying, what is it when you're in mushin? And maybe the monk was saying, the monk was expecting Umon to say, oneness at last, But instead, Umon says, no preaching on oneness. So this is a wonderful, puzzling koan, and it's even more puzzling. This is case 15 in the Heikigan Roku. It's called Umon's No Preaching on Oneness. Case 14 is Umon's Preaching Facing Oneness. And in that one, a monk said to Umon, what is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime? And Umon said, preaching facing oneness. Okay? So a monk said to Umon, what is the essential teaching of the Buddha? Umon says, preaching facing oneness. Now, one page forward, a monk asks Umon, what is it when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself? Umon said, no preaching on oneness. So these are wonderful, wonderful koans. We all want oneness, right? You hear the word oneness fairly often. It's a concept that people readily accept. So, people talk about our oneness as Americans, for example, or they talk about, members of a family should feel oneness, and so on and so on. And in religious discourses or spiritual discourses, the oneness is thought to be the highest achievement, right? So what does it mean for Umon to say, no preaching on oneness? Oneness is something we all want. You know, we all want to live in a world that's whole, that is responsive to us in a warm and friendly way, that where we feel at home. You know, we all want to live in a world where we feel at home. We all want to live in a world where we don't have to deal with conflict and discord and disagreement. My brother and I had a complicated relationship. My brother died of cancer a long time ago now. He was the younger brother, and we were 2 years apart. And, you know, I think there's a dynamic in some families where the two brothers, and it's probably the same for sisters, you know, the two brothers are vying for the upper hand. And so maybe people don't consciously think I'm going to vie for the upper hand, but I definitely think there's a sort of sibling rivalry. It really exists, you know. And so, you know, no matter what I said, my brother would disagree with me, you know. So if I said, you know, I really love, this, you know, it could be something like, I really love Coke, I don't like Coke. But if I said, I really love Coke, my brother would say, oh, Coke's not that good. You know, 7-Up is much better. And, you know, we had a kind of relationship like that, you know. So I remember once I love art, and I took my brother to the Metropolitan Museum. And you know, I showed him these works of art that I really loved, and he started criticizing them, right? And my brother, you know, he was different from me, you know. But he started criticizing these works of art, like, oh, that's not such a good painting, you know. And I remember my brother was not into the arts, right? So I took him to see this statue that I like. It's called Hercules and Antaeus. And Antaeus was a god associated with the powers of the earth, and Hercules had to fight him, and he couldn't defeat Antaeus until he lifted Antaeus off the ground. And once Antaeus was disconnected from the ground, he lost his magical powers, and then Hercules could defeat him. So it's, you know, I'm not a fan of the myth, but it was a beautiful statue, you know. And I showed my brother the statue, and I thought he'd be very moved, and he said, oh, come on, nobody has muscles like this. So my brother liked to work out, you know. So it was a lost cause, you know. So, you know, I'm a Democrat. I'm a social. I'm not just a Democrat. I'm a socialist. My brother was a Republican. You know, it was like on and on. So, you know, we could not have a accord. You know, the only way we could get along, as we got older, we got along by not getting too close, right? I mean, I loved my brother. He loved me. But, you know, we didn't take long for these tensions to surface. And, you know, I longed for my sister, she always used to, my family was a very argumentative family. And my sister was always the one she was the codependent one who was trying to fix everything and make everybody get along. And her dream was that we would like go on these family outings and we'd all have a good time and get along. And it never happened, right? It was just like doomed not to happen. We all want to go. My sister, I love my sister, and I understand she wanted so much to have oneness, right? Oneness, just once, you know, oneness, one afternoon of oneness. And we all want that, right? And this is a natural desire to have oneness. And you could say, what are we doing in a zendo if it's not to experience oneness? Yunmen himself says, you know, what is the monk said to Yunmen, what is the essence of the Buddha's teaching, his Buddha's life? What is his life all about? And preaching, facing oneness, right? You know, so we all buy that. And now Yunmen's coming along and saying, not going to happen, you know. And you know, my poor sister, who wanted so much for all of us to get along and would think of these things we could do together, you know, can we all just get along? I can hear her saying that in the car. Can't we just have a moment of harmony, you know? And poor Laura, you know, she never got her moment of harmony. So, you know, we all want oneness. We all want harmony, and this is a natural and laudable, like really praiseworthy human desire, and very healthy. But on the other hand, you know, it can be kind of a trap too. Can be kind of a trap, because we want oneness so much sometimes that we can't be honest with ourselves about the real situation. You know, I have a friend, and I went to visit him, and you know, I would say he has an unhappy marriage, you know. Sometimes the tension between him and his wife is so thick you could cut it with a knife, as they say. So I was asking him once, you know, we're pretty good friends, and I said, so how's it going, you know, how's it with Mary? And he said, oh, great, we have a wonderful relationship. You know, it's like, you know, I felt like saying, no, you don't, you know. It's not my place to say that. I wanted him to be my friend, and wouldn't be helpful, you know, to do that. But it seemed to me as there might be emotional compensations for his relationship, but from the outside, it looked like a very unhappy relationship. There was a lot of I think wishful thinking in his response to my question. I think he wants with his whole heart to have a wonderful relationship, but in fact, it's actually, I would say, like very, very unhappy marriage. It's the case that his desire for oneness sort of won't allow him to see the absence of oneness. And this is a principle that happens all the time, wherever we look in life, you know. In political language, you know, people often say we have to pull together as Americans. We're all one. And you know, I agree that we need to cooperate, but you know, that sometimes when people say that, they're trying to erase real problems which haven't been solved. You know, and you know, we can all put a flag outside of our house on the 4th of July, but that doesn't solve a lot of our problems. And you know, people are afraid sometimes to address those problems because they're so afraid they're going to lose their oneness, you know. So I grew up in the 60s. I was too young to go to the Vietnam War, but I definitely was in college, just starting college as the Vietnam War was ending. This really tore our country apart. And people used to say, you know, you hippies are not loyal Americans, you know, and you're betraying your people, you're betraying your country, you know. And so this is a way that sort of the idea of oneness can become very deceptive and oppressive. You know, we should have had a frank conversation as our country about what we were doing attacking the Vietnamese people, you know, who never hurt us, you know. And we never had that conversation. It always came down to you're either with us or you're against us. Which is it going to be? And so anytime you criticized, you were against us, the us, You know, so oneness is a problem in a certain way. We all want it, but actually, you know, it makes us sometimes scared to look closely at our real situation, you know. I have a friend who is a psychotherapist, and he often deals with family practice, and he says, you know, he'll be dealing with people who basically have been unhappy for, you know, a long, long time, like 15 years, you know. And he's, you know, basically people, the ideal of the family, of the relationship is so powerful that people basically won't look at the problems that need to be solved to make the relationship a happy one. You know, so I'm certainly not suggesting that, I think there's conflict in all human relationships. You know, long, long ago, I gave a Taisho on a Saturday, and I said, in the Taisho, I said, my wife and I were having a big, I've been married for 40 years, and I said, my wife and I were having a big fight, and then I went on. And after the Taisho, this person came up to me and he said, I can't believe it. You have a fight with your wife? You know, what kind of Zen master are you? You know, really? And I never saw the guy again. It was like, wow. I said, of course we do. You know, I've been married for 40 years. What do you think? You know, I mean, most days we have a great time together, but you know, there's going to be conflict, right? I mean, I think you have to look at the conflicts. You have to say, why are we arguing? You know, usually when, you know, one party is arguing with the other, there's a motive, right? And you have to be willing to say, okay, this is not the ideal marriage. So what's going on in our relationship? Not looking at not looking for oneness all the time allows you to be more honest about the problems that have to be addressed. Yeah, and this is also true in Zen practice, right? I mean, it's definitely the case that in the spiritual realm, you know, I don't like that word, but when people in a religious life or whatever you want to call it, the religious realm or the spiritual realm or the people definitely do a lot of projection, and it's because they want oneness, you know. So in Seattle, we had a Zen group that when Genki Roshi came, and basically, you know, we all did sesshin together, and we had this wonderful community. And then we bought some property outside of Seattle, where we were based, and we built a temple, and we started fighting over things, right? You know, so there were a lot of people in our group who were sort of like Seattle professors, and then there were a bunch of people who were like the hippies, and then there were some other people who were like engineers who worked at Boeing, and all these groups started fighting. You know, so when we bought this land, we had to design our building and decide what we were going to build. And the hippies, and I would count myself in that group, wanted to build windmills, you know, stuff like that. And actually, Genki Roshi was a ceramicist, right? He was actually a great Japanese potter. So, you know, we planned to build his kiln, and we dug for the kiln, and we found, we looked at the site for the kiln, and Genki Roshi found actual clay on the land. He said, oh my God, this is clay. This is perfect. So we had this whole thing, you know, we didn't have a temple, we didn't have a kitchen, but we were going to have the kiln, we were going to have the, you know, we found the clay, you know, it was all going to come together somehow, right? And, you know, and the engineers were going, are you out of your mind, you know? And so it turned into a really bitter, it actually fragmented our community. Our community actually blew up. And this was so painful to see. But it was because we wanted this one. We wanted a oneness, but we weren't able to look at the problems, you know, that we had, you know, and we couldn't face them because we wanted only oneness, you know. So you know, if you have a problem with somebody, sometimes you just have to say, you know, I have a problem with that. But, you know, especially people who are, like, in Buddhist circles, they all want to be loving and kind, right? So everybody wants to be a bodhisattva. So if somebody does something, you know, like, you know, we had a Zen house, and if somebody doesn't do the dishes on their day, you know, you wouldn't think a Buddha would go in and go, God damn it, you do your job, you know? So people sort of swallow it. And then it goes on. And finally they do explode, right? It's like, you know, then they unload on the person, you know, and you didn't do the laundry, and you don't do that, and you're, you know, and so then the person's hurt, and I thought you were my friend, I thought we were sisters, you know, and you backstabbing bitch, you know. And so this stuff goes on, and especially in, you know, if you look at the history of Buddhist communities, this goes on, because the desire for oneness blinds people to the real differences, and this is true on the personal level in our practice as well, right? I mean, sometimes in Zen practice, you're going to have a bad sit, right? You're going to come in and sit down on the cushion, and sometimes working with koans is going to be very uncomfortable. You know, so the idea, you know, whenever you see a promo literature for Buddhist groups, there's usually a teacher and he's laughing, you know, it's like, you know, and he's a big smile, you know. Often it's a Tibetan guy, you know, he's a, you know, cute Tibetan guy and he's laughing and it's like, oh, great, he wears these beautiful colors and he has a place and we'll all go live there and we'll be happy, you know. And there's a wonderful aspiration. Look, Buddhism is based on the aspiration. May all, you know, Buddhism, in many schools of Buddhism, every event ends with may all beings be happy. So you know, Buddhism is the only religion that I know of that says, it doesn't say non-believers are going to hell. It doesn't. The Buddha never said that, and he absolutely didn't say that. You know, there's many roads to the truth, you know. And it also says, you know, really the highest achievement is for all beings, make all beings be happy. You know, that's the highest prayer in Buddhism. So may all beings be happy. So, yes, happiness is the goal, and it's the happiness and the oneness, right? The sense of disconnection makes us so miserable. But sometimes getting to that oneness requires us to be willing to go through the fragmentation. It's like you can't get better until you deal with the wound, right? And that's pain. It's like taking the bandage off the wound, you know, can be very painful. You know, so sometimes in Zen practice, you know, it's definitely the case that people come to Zen practice and you know, they're fine up through samadhi, and then koan training gives them a lot. That's where a fair number of people bail. Because, you know, the first time you work with a koan, you know, you can be uncomfortable. In fact, it can, quote-unquote, ruin your sit. You know, so once you're able to get into deep samadhi on the cushion, you're in this beautiful, blissful state. And, you know, a good teacher won't let you stay that long in that beautiful, blissful state. The good teacher will give you something that will, you know, basically challenge your, you know, your buzz, you know, that will kill your buzz, you know. So you know, basically, you know, a teacher might say, you know, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. And we've all had experiences like that, right? Where, you know, it's like everybody gets but me, you know? Everybody is acknowledged but me, you know? I mean, this definitely happens to my wife, you know? She, you know, she's in a place now where she comes up with all these good ideas and everybody else takes credit for them, you know? And it's sort of frustrating for her, right? You know, where people are sort of building their careers on her ideas and she doesn't get any credit, you know? So it's very important, you know, when you're working with a koan like that, to be willing to be uncomfortable, you know? And if you say, wait a minute, I'm a bodhisattva, I don't have any problems with, you know, I ask nothing for myself, you know? I just want to be generous to all who come my way, you know? That's not being honest, you know? When you're working with a koan, you know, you might suddenly realize, you know, my God damn it, you know, my brother, that little bastard, you know, he always used to get, you know, he could wrap mom around his finger, you know, and I always got the short end of the stick, you know. And I actually feel that way. You can see there's some passion. My brother, it was just like, if he just looked somewhat ill, it was like, oh, you've got to go to bed. And I could be dying on the floor, and it's like, can I get, you know, could you help me here? Oh, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. But, you know, you have to be willing to work through those difficult aspects of yourself. And, you know, and it takes a certain humility to realize, you know, I'm not an angel. I'm not a bodhisattva. I have fears. I have attachments. You know, I can be a petty son of a bitch. You know, I can, all of those things, you know. And you know, especially in quote-unquote spiritual circles, it can be hard for people to deal with that. You know, so there's a lot of projection that goes on in creating a persona for ourselves as like a bodhisattva. I'm a bodhisattva, you know. But then, you know, the person doesn't do the dishes, you know. And then the person, you know, leaves there, you know. I mean, even Genki Roshi got really mad. He made fun of, you know, he said, he was living at the Zen house, and he said, you know, he said, I went into, you know, he said, I went into the bathroom and there was half a sandwich in the bathroom, you know. And he said, who eats a sandwich, you know? You know, it was just like, he was speechless, you know. And the Japanese are, you know, wonderful in so many ways, but they do have like an anal retentive aspect, you know. So, the you know, everything is in its place. Everything has to be in its place. So the idea that somebody would be eating and going to the bathroom was like unbelievable to Genki Roshi. I don't think that was what was really happening. Maybe the person just brought the sandwich in. Who knows, right? But Genki was, you know, very upset with a lot of that stuff. You know, he actually, you know, called people slobs and things like that. You slobs, you know. Webb was translating for him during a Taisho, and Genki actually, there was a woman at the Zen house who was very much a very key person in our group, and Genki actually said, you know, Donna is such a slob, you know, and I could see Glenn hesitating to translate this. He said something like, Donna can sometimes be careless, or something like that. You know? So, you know, being willing to not be a bodhisattva, you know, we're bodhisattvas in process, but we're human beings. And we have to deal with our stuff. And it's not easy. It's very difficult to see things truly. People are so self-deceiving about how difficult it is to see things the way they are. You know, we all, you know, one of my teachers, it used to say that human beings secrete ideas and thoughts the way an oyster secretes its shell. So, you know, we protect ourselves by creating this rosy aura of fantasy around our world. And again, it has a good intention. We want to live in what the Buddhists call Sukhavati. Sukhavati is like a world where everybody is awake, everybody is compassionate and kind. You know, when we look in our own hearts, there's loving kindness for all. You know, so Sukhavati is an ideal worth pursuing. But we have to, we're not there yet, and the work of getting to Sukhavati, getting to Nirvana, is not escaping from samsara, but working through samsara. And so this is what, you know, Ullmann was trying to say, not so fast. You know, we have to look at our stuff, we have to look at our confusion and our negatives, right? And you know, this is in general the method of Zen. You know, going into you achieve oneness. How do we achieve oneness? By going into fragmentation. See, oneness is achieved in fragmentation. See, actually, Buddhism doesn't really always use the word oneness. Oneness. We use the word non-duality, non-duality. And that's different from oneness, see? The not two is different from the one. See, you could say they're pointing to the same thing, but it's a different spirit to say non-duality. Because, you know, every koan puts you in the middle of a contradiction. Every koan accentuates accentuates yourself, your sense of being divided, a divided person. If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will, you know, take it away. That's a contradiction, you know, logically. But it's also, there's a contradiction there between the fact that you maybe want to be a loving being and also feel a lot of resentment towards your brother, you know, for always upstaging you as a child. And so, you know, we're always split, we're always divided and pulled and cut. And, you know, we want to be whole, but the way to get whole is not through oneness. It's, you go into the split and something happens in the middle of that. So, you know, what happens with every koan is that you experience more intensely this dividedness, this sense of fragmentation or separation or something like that. And then what happens is if you work on the koan long enough, you go through like a gestalt switch. It's like your perspective changes. And suddenly there's like a bigger view. There's a bigger view. And in that bigger view, it all fits together. So it's like if you ever look at Tibetan mandalas, you know, mandalas are made up of all these little scenes. And if you look at any part of the mandala, it just seems like chaos. But when you step back and you see the whole mandala, you realize, oh, there's a symmetry here, there's order, and this is all coming together. And if you just saw a piece of the mandala, it wouldn't look like that. It's a great teaching device, you know. And koans are like that too, you know, you experience the contradiction intensely, and it can cause you some upset. You know, if you're working on a koan, sometimes you don't have a blissful sit. You can have a sit where you're troubled, and actually if you're mentally agitated about your koan, it can actually make pain in your legs, you know, so it can even have a physical dimension. You know, so your sits can be pretty lousy sometimes as you're trying to work through a koan. Not that you have to punish yourself, but it might happen. I remember once, I came home from a sesshin and I was working in the backyard, and I remember, I can't remember, I picked up something and just threw it across the yard. I was so goddamn mad. And I, you know, I was like, why did I do that, you know? But I think the koan was just eating away at me, you know? So you know, that doesn't sound very pleasant. But you know, on the other side, you go into the contradiction, and then you have this change of perspective, and suddenly you realize it all fits together. And this is a bigger world. Now it's like you have that oneness, or rather you have non-duality. See, there's a difference there, but there's an enclosing connectedness, right? And so you have to be truthful about the distinctions, but and that's difficult for us to do. You know, the first part of this koan is so interesting. Engo's introduction, the life-dealing blade, the death-dealing blade, the life-giving sword. These were common in ancient days and are still today the touchstone. So it sounds like he's talking about some Chinese, ancient Chinese sword, which there is this stuff in Chinese legend about life-giving magical swords, like in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the Green Destiny sword, right? But that's not the sword he's talking about. Engo is talking about the sword of Manjushri. See, on the altar, Manjushri, there's a little tiny Manjushri on the altar here, and he's carrying a little sword. And Manjushri is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. And Manjushri has a sword. In one hand, he has a scroll, which is like a sutra. And in the other, he has a sword. And you might think, well, what is the Bodhisattva doing with a sword? But he has to cut through. That's the sword of Mu. We use the sword of Mu to cut through our illusions and see things as they really are. And so that's the method. Koans are part of the method of Zen, but the essence of Zen is using the sword of Mu to cut through our illusions. So difficult to see things the way they are. We secrete ideas like an oyster secretes a shell, but you keep cutting away and cutting away, and then finally you experience the reality. And then we do it again and again and again. So, you know, even people who have had Daikensho must continue this practice, or the idea of Daikensho just becomes an image in their minds that they cling to, an empty memory. You know, we have to keep cutting and cutting away. Part of our nature is, you know, we are symbolic animals. We are dreaming animals. We are language-using animals, image-using animals. And we do secrete those things. So we have to keep cutting away to see things as they are. And then, of course, all of those things can be used for good, right? The imagination, ideas, thought, feeling, knowledge, and imagination are of no value, but also in the verses on the heart mind, he says, you know, ideas have their place too, right? The arts have their place too, but their proper place is, they emerge in their proper place when we cut through our illusions with the sword of Manjushri. Engo's introduction, the death-dealing blade, the life-giving sword, they were the custom in ancient days and still today are the touchstone. Tell me at this moment, what is the death-dealing blade? What is the life-giving sword? See the following. Main subject, a monk asks Umon, what is it when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself? Umon says, no preaching on oneness. Secho's verse, no oneness. Each holds one tally. He lives and dies with you all the same. The 84,000 did not respond quickly. The 33 entered the tiger's cave. Remarkable. See how turbulent the moon reflected on the waves. See, I mean, the moon is the symbol of enlightenment. And the water reflecting the moon is a symbol of the mind awake. But look, he's talking about turbulent waves reflecting the light of enlightenment. It's not what we usually think. But enlightenment is enlightenment, whether the waves are turbulent or the water is placid. You know, sometimes you have to confront the turbulent waves. Thank you.